Well, let's see. I'm going to try to reconstruct history a little bit here. Let's see. The last time you were here, you were here to talk about your first novel, which
yes.
was called Coming Attractions, and that was a novel. I meant to drag it out and look at it again, but I forgot to do it. But as I recall, it was about Miss Mississippi.
Yes, exactly.
So we talked then. What year was that?
81.
It's been 6 years?
Yes. Six long years.
Actually, I first saw you as a member of the audience at the upstairs or the downstairs.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And that must have been 21 years ago.
That was around 68, 69?
Yeah. 67?
Somewhere around in there, yeah.
That's right.
I forgot.
Part of that review.
That's right.
Wonderful review.
Thank you.
Why don't you give me a little thumbnail sketch? Now, there's some biographical data here about you, but I'd like to hear it right from you. Tell me about you're from Mississippi, aren't you?
No, I'm from Alabama.
How do you tell the difference? They all talk alike down there.
No. Oh, no. You must never say that to a Southerner. Because, you know, it's strange. The South is very much like England. You can tell exactly where somebody is from just by listening to them. We always kid because Mississippians have very Southern accents, much more so than Alabama. So we always call them the real deep Southerners, you know, and the people from the Delta. You know, everybody always questions their sanity.
You're not from Whistlestop.
No, I'm from Birmingham, which is a rather large city. And I actually grew up in an apartment. I don't have the typical Southern background. My father was a motion picture machine operator, so was my grandfather. So I grew up literally in the movies, sitting in the balcony of theaters all my life.
You grew up in show business.
I did. There was my mother at one time was a cashier, so I always say I come from a showbiz family.
Then what happened?
Well, then I went into the Miss Alabama pageant for 7 years in a row and never won, and tried to send myself to school, and I won scholarships, and I used to write these little comedy routines, and I would do them, and I finally won a scholarship to the Pittsburgh Playhouse, and I went there and studied drama, and then came to New York and got a job at the upstairs at the downstairs where you saw me, and then I went to work for Alan Funt on Candid Camera as a writer for about 8 or 9 years, and then
you also acted in that series.
I did.
If you want to call it acting.
Yeah.
Posing.
Yeah. Playing with people. Mm-hmm. Playing with people, yeah. And
that was before somebody ran off with all of Funt's money.
Yes. It wasn't me, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, I think the guy who ran off with it went to jail. Or committed suicide.
Suicide was something awful, yeah. So, no, that was right after I stopped working there. So.
Then you went out to the...
Then I went out to the West Coast.
You were hoping to find earthquakes or something.
No. I didn't want to. I actually went from New York to Phoenix because I went to the West Coast originally because I was doing the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was a sitcom, but we filmed it in Phoenix. And so I was in Phoenix for 2 years. Then I came to L.A.
I don't remember that show. What was that
one? It was called The New Dick Van Dyke Show.
Mm-hmm.
The old one had Mary Tyler Moore, Rosemarie. This one had Hope Lang, myself, and Dick, and it was on 2 years, and it didn't do that well.
That only lasted longer than 13 weeks.
Yes, that's true.
It wasn't too bad.
No, not at all.
But I suppose that the West Coast attracted you because there must be more show business opportunity there.
It's true, Don. For some reason, New York lost most of the television at one period. Now it's coming back, thank goodness. But there are more opportunities to work out there. I actually don't live in Los Angeles. I moved to Santa Barbara, which I dearly love. So I would, commute back and forth. But
why did you move to Santa Barbara?
Because I love it. It's so pretty. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's beautiful. And I found a house that was very old, and it reminded me of Alabama.
Doesn't that get you out of the mainstream?
Yes. It does, but I was more interested in writing, so it worked out very well.
Are you a neighbor of President Reagan's?
No. He's way up in the hills, you know. People say he lives in Santa Barbara, but actually he lives way past Santa Barbara, like up in the hills. So I never see him. I hear the helicopters flying up and down the coast whenever he's in town. And, of course, a lot of the press stays in Santa Barbara, but mm-hmm. I never see him.
Well, Santa Barbara sounds like an idyllic location. I haven't been there. Of course, I've seen pictures of it. Matter of fact, there was a television series that was set there a while ago. And
yeah.
As I recall, all of the buildings had red roofs.
Uh-huh. Red tile roofs.
Yeah. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
It struck me as very pretty.
It is beautiful.
So it looks like a good place to do a lot of writing.
It is. It is. It's very good.
Except for the noise of the helicopters.
That's true.
And the aftershock.
And, yeah. Yeah. But I was in Los Angeles when they, because I'm working on the Dolly Parton show. So I have an apartment in L.A. And it's a 12th floor apartment. So the morning of the earthquake, I was thrown out of bed, and I was flying across the room. It was pretty scary.
Well, Fanny Flagg, let's talk about fried green tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. This is a more ambitious effort than your first novel. And it's interesting because the story is not told chronologically, but skips back and forth. By the time you finish the book, it's almost like life itself, because life, while we live in a chronological way, our experiences are that. We fill in. For example, mm-hmm. you'll learn something in the first grade, and it's amplified when you're in high school, and on. We piece life together somehow, and that's essentially how you approach this novel. Tell me about the genesis of this book.
Well, originally when I was started to write it, it was a first-person novel, and I wanted to talk tell about a woman who was 87 years old, who's in a nursing home, and I thought it would just be her reminiscing about her life. And that's how it started, and as I was writing it, when she was in the nursing home, all of a sudden somebody came in the visitor's lounge and sat down and started talking to her, and I thought she was just going to sit there and listen. But unfortunately, this character started talking herself and started to have a life of her own, which I didn't intend. And then in flashing back on the old lady's life, all these people started having different lives of their own. So it turned out to be much more of a book than I thought it was going to be. I always thought it was going to be just like a very small, little, simple first narrative book, but it didn't turn out that way.
No, you have a lot of characters in there. But as you wrote it, how did you organize it mentally? For example, the various plots, subplots and so forth, did you write those separately and then integrate them in the book in the way that finally materialized?
Well, yes. I think there's about 230 different segments of the book. And at one time, if you'd come to my house, I wrote them separately. And I became personally so confused, I didn't know what was going on. So I took a clothesline and I strung it down one hall. And I hung all these pieces of this book on a clothesline. And I spent 2 or 3 months just walking down the halls looking at it, trying to figure out how in the world to get it all together. Because I couldn't figure it out. I thought, oh no, I really don't have a book. I just have like a bunch of little things. And finally, one day, I just sat down and put it all together and hoped it would fit. And it seemed to fit. So I was thrilled. But at one point, it was just a clothesline full of little pieces of paper.
Now, the characters in the book, did they come out of your childhood experience?
Some of them did. The older lady, Mrs. Cleo Threadgood, was a combination of a lot of old people. I love to talk to older people. And it was a combination of a lot of people that I've talked to and stories that I've heard. But then some of the characters, I don't know where they came from. They just came out of the blue.
Well, my favorite character is the tomboy who's...
Iggy.
Iggy.
Yeah, Iggy.
I've never heard of a name like that.
Iggy, yeah. Her real name was Imogene, so they called her Iggy. Mm-hmm. And a friend of, I have, a friend who's in her 80s, and her name is Iggy, and I always thought that was great, so I stole her name.
Well, Iggy's a little mysterious because you don't reveal until the very last chapter before the recipes what happened to her. But I'm not sure how she... I don't want to spoil the plot for anybody, but at least you can tell me. How did she get... He was in Florida, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did she get there? And who was the man she was living with? Vernon? Was he in the book?
Yeah, that was her brother.
Her brother?
Yeah, see, I gave you a clue early on that he had moved down to Florida. And so she moved down there with him.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. You have an awful lot in here about race relations.
Yes.
And, I assume, I haven't been, well, of course, I grew up in Houston, Texas, and in the time I grew up there, there was a color line that was very severe, mm-hmm. with separate drinking fountains in the back of the bus and the balcony of the motion picture theater. It's not that way now. But obviously when you were growing up, it had to be that way, and obviously it was that way up through the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So as you grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, what were your impressions about the racial relations?
Well, it's my impression, when you're growing up in a place, you don't understand, you don't know. It's hard to, you know, one of the reasons that I did put a lot about that in the book is that I became very concerned about the fact that I was growing up in a town that did, when I was very young, I can still remember on the streetcars when I was about 4 or 5 years old that there was a board that you would move where black people sat in the back of a bus, and you don't, when you grow up that way, it doesn't, you don't think about it. And I became very concerned with the fact that I could grow up in a situation like that and not really understand the enormity of it. And I became very interested about how people can live that way and not really understand how horrible it is. And I, of course, began to understand how horrible it was when I got older and saw things that were, you know, terrible, terribly unfair. But one of the reasons I have so many black characters, and they span, it starts in 1918 and it goes up to 1988, actually, and the changes in the South have been so tremendous. And the relationships between the races in the South are so much better than sometimes relationships in some northern cities, because the people had a closeness. Although it was a social situation that was unbearable, they lived very close to each other, so they knew each other. They weren't frightened of each other. And so when I go home to the South, I'm always amazed how beautifully the South has integrated.
Well, when I grew up in Texas, I didn't know that there was discrimination. I knew there was a color line, mm-hmm. but we accepted that, and we didn't know it was discrimination.
No.
I had no idea.
No. It's amazing what you will accept as a child not knowing any better.
And
know?
I heard very few references to blacks. I grew up in a white suburban mm-hmm. neighborhood. There were no blacks around,
mm-hmm.
no Mexicans,
mm-hmm.
although there are Mexican restaurants all over the city, but and we love the Mexican food, but we never ran into any Mexicans,
yeah.
except those who were yard men,
yeah.
or maids and uh-huh. things like that. But we had no idea. At least I didn't as a child. Mm-hmm. Had no idea that this system yeah. was discriminatory.
Well, actually, one of the characters in the book, Mrs. Evelyn Couch, goes through a real catharsis in her mind about that. And she talks about the fact that she was living in Birmingham, going to high school, and had no idea that 4 or 5 blocks from her house were people living in great despair, very unhappy and treated very badly. And she wasn't even aware of it. And it's... I had a television show in Birmingham during the time of the marches. And even though it was my hometown, I was completely unaware that people were unhappy. And that's pretty scary when you think about it. But I came from an extremely liberal family in the fact that my father was one of the first people to integrate the unions in the South, and I never heard any kind of discriminatory language in my home. You know, it was just never allowed. I never thought about it.
But the blacks still had to sit in the balcony in his theaters.
No, actually not, because by the time I was about 4 or 5 years old, that had stopped, and the blacks had their own theaters. And but at the when earlier in the 30s and the early 40s, the black people were made to sit in the balcony.
Do you get back to Alabama frequently?
Constantly.
So it's not a culture shock for you?
Oh, no. No, no. I go back at least 2 or 3 times a year. I have many, many friends down there. And as a matter of fact, I did most of the research for this book in Birmingham, because I went back and I had to go through old newspapers of that period and talk to people. and find out exactly what was going on, because the book is basically set in the Depression, a time that interests me greatly, although I didn't live through it. I always had a romantic idea about it, because I was always fascinated with the way I perceived people were close to each other in times of trouble. And it was so in the South. Blacks and whites were very close to each other during the Depression, because economically they were basically all were suffering, because everybody was poor, you know, in this particular area I'm speaking about. And so I went to Birmingham, and I spent, 6 or 7 months literally doing research down there. And I'm also on I'm on the board of the directors of a theater there, the little theater where I started when I was about 16. So I constantly go back home.
Do you ever do any work there?
I make it a point to, about every year or every 2 years, I go back and I do a play. I'll either direct a play or I'm in a play. And I have a lot of friends still back there. I am a person who, I feel so funny because most people say, oh, I couldn't wait to get out of my hometown. I hated my hometown. I happen to love my hometown. And the only reason I left Birmingham is because I couldn't make a living there. Because when I had a television show there, it was very difficult for a female to get ahead. I was making, at the time, I was doing an hour and a half television show, and I was making $50 a week, if you can believe it. And I kept asking for a raise, and they said, no, we don't want to give you a raise, because just as soon as we give you a raise, you'll get married, and then we will have spent all this money on you. So I literally left because I wanted to make it a career, you know. And I probably would have been very happy staying. And I am constantly in awe and in amazement at the genuine sweetness of people in the South and in Texas and all around in that area. I find the people down there very, very kind. It's so funny, we're talking about the earthquake. I was, like I said, on the 12th floor of that building, and when the building started shaking, I ran down 12 flights of stairs, and I had on my nightgown, which I didn't realize until I was downstairs, and everybody started piling out of the building. And in their pajamas or what have you, and a man came out, and I looked at him and I said, well, hello. And he looked at me very strangely, and this was like, could be potentially, you know, dangerous situation because of, we could have been killed. And he said, excuse me, do I know you? And I thought, oh, that's odd. That's because I have a tendency to speak to everyone that's very Southern. My mother used to come visit me from Alabama, and by the time she got off the plane, she'd have 10 people lined up that she would introduce me to, and she would tell me who they were, what they did, and so that it's something I miss. And being a writer, I'm very interested in what people have to say and the oral histories of people, and the Southerners do not have any hesitancy about telling you everything you want to know.
Oh, I'm always curious. When I get back to Texas, where my family still lives there, and I get back, I'm amazed. You're going to a store or a restaurant. Hi, how are you?
Yes.
And have a nice day.
Have a nice day.
And they're so polite. We don't do that here.
No, we don't. But, you know, this is basically...
They carry a lot of guns down there, too, and they shoot each other pretty badly.
Well, that's Texas. Texas is pretty... don't they have, like, the highest murder rate in the world or something?
I think Detroit does.
Detroit or whatever. But one of the reasons I wrote this book is it is dedicated to the sweet people, the nice people, which is the majority of the people, I think, in this country. I said it in the South because that's what I know. That's where I'm from. But I am dedicated to... and it's something I've always been interested in the middle-class person who never gets written about, who never gets any kind of recognition. And to me, these are the real heroes of life, people that just get up every day, go to work, do their job, and live these lives and are sweet to people. And it's something that constantly amazes me about people. I am an only child. I come from a very small family. And I will never forget this. When my mother died, I went home naturally, and we lived on my parents lived on a street, I'm guessing maybe 20 houses. And I all of a sudden I looked up and I could see the doors opening all up and down the streets, and quietly, people that I really didn't know because I'd been away from home so long, people just very quietly coming to the house and bringing food and quietly saying, well, if there's anything I can do, and the yard being mowed and things being taken care of, and that whole spirit of being close to each other and being neighborly, which I miss very much. And these are the people that I think never really get written about. You know, history is basically written about and by victors. Very few books are written about people that just live lives that aren't spectacular, but I think that lives are spectacular.
Well, it's a wonderful and ambitious book, Fannie Fay.
Thank you.
My last question, I'd like for you to comment a little bit about those recipes in the back. That's an added attraction. I mean,
yes.
here you can enjoy this book from a literary level, but at the end you can also work up an appetite.
Yes.
These are the dishes that you cook at home, I guess.
Oh, yes, that's right, every night. No, this is, what is basically now known and is very trendy as soul food is food that I grew up on, and that was just, you know, everyday cooking. And I have a theory that food is very emotional. I know that when I go home to I go to Texas a lot too. The first thing I want to do when I go home is I want to have black-eyed peas, turnip greens, pork chops, everything that I grew up as a child, because it's very comforting to have that kind of food. And since the book takes place, the main setting is the cafe, the Whistle Stop Cafe, which is a place that did exist, and every little town has a cafe like that. This is the kind of food they served, and it's the kind of food I grew up on. And I thought, well, listen, I'll take the recipes, because in the book, everybody's always eating something. So I thought, well, I'll just put the recipes in.
Well, I'm a little afraid to try your recipes. I'm afraid I might cook it, and as I begin to eat, I'll find a glass eye on the plate.
Oh, gosh. They won't know what that is.
That's an in-joke.
They're going
to have to read Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe to find out about that. Fannie Fay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you for a second.